Welcome to TAC Beechcroft's NHS Estates podcast series. My name is Lisa Geary and I'm a partner in the real estate team here at TAC Beechcroft, specialising in health. I'm pleased to be joined today by Victoria Armstrong, who is also a partner in the real estate team, specialising in health at TAC Beechcroft. This is episode 2 in our NHS Estates podcast series. And today we're talking about the varying forms of occupational arrangements which can be granted by NHS Trusts as landlord and the key points to bear in mind to ensure the right arrangement is put in place. So to start, let's remind ourselves what guidance Estate Code gives for the grant of new leases to third parties, whether it's to other NHS organisations, voluntary groups, GPs or other private providers, and any other occupational arrangements, including retail outlets, for example. The purpose of these occupations can vary from service provision, operational for the purposes of healthcare, to income generation, and can be temporary or more permanent in nature. A common question we get asked by our clients is not only what the terms of the deal should be, but additionally, what form of arrangement should be used. For example, should it be a lease, a licence, a moto, a moo, a tenancy at will, etc. Estate Code covers very useful tips and guidance for NHS trusts when granting different types of arrangements to various occupiers. Let's remind ourselves of some of those now. Victoria, you have had a lot of experience of advising NHS trusts on a range of occupational arrangements with a range of occupiers. Could you outline some of these key generic top tips which are in their estate code?
Yes, of course. I think that would be a really useful reminder for all of us before we get into the detail. So my top tips or key outline of the takeaways from today would be to take care when looking to grant occupational arrangements. They mustn't interfere with the provision of health and social care, which is, of course, the core business of the NHS. The key focus of an NHS trust is to provide healthcare services. So when taking on landlord responsibilities, it's important that a trust balances the extent of any management responsibilities with the financial and other benefits to be obtained from the letting, and to ensure that the former doesn't negatively outweigh the latter. It's vital to ensure the proposed occupier has the covenant strength to meet the obligations of the occupation, so rent, service charge, utility payments, repairing liabilities and associated costs, to name but a few. For non-intra NHS arrangements, it's important to consider whether rent deposits and guarantees should be requested. And when entering into any new arrangement, make sure you use the correct form of occupational document. And we'll move on to this in detail, so more on this later, but it's essential not to create a lease unintentionally without ensuring that you deal with security of tenure issues, where you need to ensure you will be able to regain control of the space at the end of the letting. Don't allow an occupier into occupation until the terms are agreed and the correct document signed. Otherwise, unintended implied terms may arise and there will be occupation without a clear outline of risks and liabilities there. And finally, ensure you take the correct professional advice on any occupational arrangement at an early stage while the deal is being negotiated. For example, surveying or valuation advice, legal advice, financial advice. Your advisors will be able to guide you through all of this to ensure compliance with the estate code as far as possible and to help you document the correct audit trail in respect of any deviations from estate code.
Thank you, Victoria. I think we mentioned it in our previous podcast in this series that we both of us find it really helpful to have a estate code sitting next to us on our desks. And we always say to clients, it's always helpful to dust it down and ensure that those themes that you outline and any others that are relevant to the transaction are held in mind and checked each time a third party moves into space on the NHS estate. Even if the nature of the transaction does not allow all of the ideals to be achieved, it is important to show they have been considered and that you provide an audit trail to explain why they could not be agreed in a particular instance. And this will also help the board to sign off on any proposals which need its approval. I think it would be useful at this point for me to give an overview of the two different forms or two different legal forms of occupational arrangement and the differences between the two, the lease and the licence. There are also other operational derivatives of these two forms, and we will cover those, namely tenancies at will, implied periodic tenancies, motos and moos later on. So to start, a bit of technical stuff. A lease is one of the legal estates in land and the other is freehold ownership. Once you have a valid lease, once a valid lease is granted and properly registered at the land registry where it needs to be registered, it not only creates a personal binding contract between the landlord and the tenant, but also an arrangement which attaches to the land itself and then can bind subsequent owners of the freehold. So that a lease is a right arrangement to grant where the occupier will have exclusive possession of an area, a defined area, for a set period of time, which is the lease term. It will need to be granted by deed where it's for 3 years or more and will need to be registered at the land registry with its own leasehold title where it's granted for more than 7 years. If the landlord sells its interest in the property subject to the lease, then provided all those things are in place, the lease will bind the new owner. On the other hand, a licence arrangement is a purely personal arrangement between the two original contracting parties. This arrangement in the context of land will arise where there's no exclusive possession of the area occupied, or maybe where the formalities for the grant of a lease might not have been satisfied. So I do realise that this may sound a little technical, and I think it would be useful to give some examples of what we mean by exclusive possession and to illustrate the difference between a valid lease and a licence. Victoria, I know you had a recent situation where you had to explain this in quite a lot of detail to a client. Could you set out what's meant by exclusive possession?
Of course. It can be quite a difficult one to understand without an example, actually. The important thing here is to be clear about what is happening in reality on the ground. You can't change the nature of an arrangement simply by giving it a specific name or including terms which are not actually operative just to try and bring it into another legal bracket. So the name given to a document isn't determinative of the type of arrangement in place. A lease could still exist regardless of the name or the terms of the document where exclusive possession is granted to the occupier. So the meaning of exclusive possession, it really relates to control over a defined space. As you've said, Lisa, it's one of the key elements of a lease. A person has exclusive possession if it can exercise the rights of the owner and exclude the owner and third parties from the space, save to the extent that the owner has reserved rights of entry, for instance. There are a lot of elements to consider when it comes to establishing the true nature of an arrangement, and there's a lot of case law on this topic, so the detail is definitely one for another podcast. But I agree it would be useful to look at an example of a lease and a licence arrangement. Turning to a lease, let's assume a trust agrees with the RVS that they can occupy an area at the entrance of the hospital for running its cafe service for a period of 5 years. Under the arrangement, the RVS will have full control of the area and the trust will only have the usual rights reserved in the lease to enter and inspect the premises to ensure the RVS is complying with the terms of the lease or where the trust needs to carry out repairs to its adjoining property and can't do so without entering the RVS space. Effectively, the trust's rights of entry are limited and it is the RVS which has full control subject to those rights. So the RVS has exclusive possession here and this arrangement would be a lease. In terms of legal housekeeping, the lease should be granted by deed. As you've said, because it is for a term of 5 years, the lease won't have its own registered title at the land registry, but the lease can be noted on the trust's freehold title to the hospital. If the concourse is sold to a third party at some point over the 5 years, then the lease would bind the new owner of the concourse as landlord. So turning next to a licence. For this example, let's say an NHS trust grants a physiotherapist the right to use a room within a building on a hospital site for 3 hours on a Tuesday and a Thursday morning each week. There are a number of other available and suitable rooms in the building, and the location of the room used by the physiotherapist can be varied by the trust at any time. This arrangement would be a licence, as the physiotherapist doesn't have control over a defined area, and so it doesn't have exclusive possession. If the trust sold the building, the licence wouldn't per se, without additional legal arrangements, bind the new owner of the building, and it may actually fall away. It's likely that the physio would need to enter into a new arrangement with the new owner of the building to be able to continue to use that space.
Oh, thank you. That really helps to clarify the difference. Fortunately, estate code gives good guidance about which arrangements to use or which arrangement to use, but it's also really important to speak to your legal advisors to make sure that you are thinking about the right document, because it can lead to all sorts of issues if you, for example, grant a license when actually it should have been a contracted out lease. Come on to that now. It's very clear, and this is what estate code says, that licences should not be used where the arrangement is in fact and reality a lease. And what we mean by that is where there's exclusive use of a property for a defined period. This is because security of tenure under the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 may arise inadvertently and cause issues for the landlord in recovering possession of the area at the end of the defined period. This can occur even where the licence states that there is no exclusive possession. For example, there may be a relocation clause stating that the landlord can relocate the tenant, the area occupied by the tenant, at any time, when in fact the reality is that this does not actually happen and could not happen on the ground. For example, where you have a bespoke area and there are simply aren't any alternatives. There are lots of cases which have gone to court where the wording in the document has not reflected the reality, and so the court has found for the occupier, usually awarding security of tenure rights. Victoria, we both speak about the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954 on an everyday basis, and it's an essential consideration on any non-residential letting arrangement. It may help to outline what the Act provides. Why do you think, or why is this such an important thing to get right?
So this Act deals with security of tenure rights for business tenants. In simple terms, where an occupier has exclusive possession of premises for the purposes of its business, it will generally obtain security of tenure rights, meaning that it will have a statutory right to renew its tenancy at the end of the contractual term. A landlord is only able to oppose that request for renewal on certain limited grounds, which are set out in the Act, and a defined statutory procedure must also be followed strictly in order to bring the lease to an end. If the landlord successfully makes out one of those grounds, it will be entitled to regain possession of the let area and to defeat the tenant's continued occupation and/or request for a renewal lease. But the burden of proof is heavier on the landlord. The grounds can be difficult to prove and they are narrow. They cover situations such as redevelopment of the premises by the landlord, a situation where a landlord needs the premises for its own use, and a situation where there may be tenant breaches of the lease. It's important to note as well that compensation may be payable to a tenant in some situations where a ground is successfully proved and a landlord is entitled to repossess. Most occupiers of the NHS estate will be occupying either for the provision of healthcare or commercial services, i.e. business reasons. An exception will, of course, be any residential tenants in staff accommodation. The Act deals with business tenants only. Residential tenancies have their own security of tenure regime under separate legislation, which is outside of the remit of this podcast, but it is just as important for trusts to obtain legal advice in respect of any residential lettings or occupations. The Act can cause issues with the operation of the NHS estate where repossession needs to be certain, either for re-procurement of services, relocation or reconfiguration, or just ensuring vacant possession for disposal or redevelopment. A genuine licence, if properly drafted, won't confer security of tenure under the Act on the occupier, but an arrangement that grants exclusive possession for over 6 months or on a periodic basis could well fall within the security of tenure regime of the Act and expose the trust to a claim by the occupier. And that is notwithstanding the fact that the arrangement is labelled a licence.
Gosh, from what you say, it's so important to get this right on any letting, and all estates managers must be alive to the risks of granting the wrong arrangement and undocumented occupations where security of tenure arises unintentionally. More on that later. However, it's not all doom and gloom, as it does not mean that whenever a lease is granted, there is security of tenure. Fortunately, the 1954 Act provides that a lease can be contracted out of the security of tenure provisions of the Act so that the landlord can regain possession as of right on the expiry of the contractual term, if the right procedure is followed before the lease is granted. This exclusion will need to be agreed with the tenant as part of the heads of terms process and wording included in the lease document to record that agreement. There is more detail to the procedure in that it involves the service of a specified form of notice on the tenant by the landlord and a declaration or statutory declaration to be made by the tenant stating that it is aware of its rights and that it has agreed to concede them for the letting in question. It's important the correct process is followed and at the right time, and legal advice is needed to ensure this is done correctly. Estate Code makes it clear and emphasises this continually that an NHS trust as landlord should always be certain that it can obtain vacant possession of any area it has let at the end of the lease term, or have very, very clear reasons why in a particular case that should not be the case. Once a lease is excluded from the 1954 Act, the landlord can take court action to obtain vacant possession when the lease expires if the tenant does not vacate. Effectively, it has a fully protected legal right to obtain repossession or to repossess. A common error is that a landlord may think that by calling a letting a licence, it becomes a licence and therefore does not attract security of tenure rights for the tenant. If it is in reality a lease and there is no statutory exclusion from the 1954 Act, security of tenure can be obtained. There are some exclusions from the 1954 Act in terms of lease arrangements. Short-term leases, less than 6 months, tenancies at will, and licences included. Obviously, a licence isn't a lease. But the point here is that they must be valid versions of that legal arrangement.
Thanks, Lisa. And there is another area of risk here. In addition to a failure to enter into and properly document the correct arrangement at the outset, there's also risk around not managing expiry of that arrangement. So that, for instance, a previously excluded lease becomes one under which the tenant obtains security of tenure under the Act after expiry of the arrangement. So even where the tenant doesn't have security of tenure, it is important to ensure that if occupation is to continue after a lease expires, negotiations take place in good time, so terms are agreed before expiry and a new contracted out lease can be put in place. This will avoid security of tenure inadvertently being obtained by the tenant remaining in occupation before a new lease is granted. And it also gives the landlord a stronger negotiating position, because once a tenant has security of tenure, we've seen time and time again, it can be hard to persuade them to give it up, and if they do, they may well want some form of payment for doing so.
Thanks, Victoria. That all makes so much sense. And it's also another reason to have all key dates, including lease expiries, diarised well in advance. However, if this isn't actually possible to manage operationally, because the fact of continued occupation or the need for continued occupation is last minute, or alternatively, it has been overlooked, Can an NHS trust as landlord still protect itself?
Yes, it can. And estate code states that the trust should write to a tenant to make it clear that any continued occupation is under a tenancy at will arrangement only, that is pending grant of a new lease in order to avoid security of tenure being obtained. This needs to be done correctly and legal advice taken and the correct documents in place. Another option would be to grant a short-term contracted out lease arrangement. I mean, the important thing is not to assume that one size fits all in this case, as certain facts and circumstances may change the advice on the correct arrangement to protect the landlords.
Thank you. We mentioned tenancies at will earlier on. What are they?
Well, a genuine tenancy at will is excluded from the Act. They can be terminated at will by either party on immediate notice at any time, so they can be terminated instantly. They create a personal arrangement between the landlord and tenant. They're fairly short and can usually be prepared and negotiated quickly. They tend to be used for temporary arrangements or during negotiations pending the formal grant of a lease. It's really important to get legal advice on the correct form of document to use here, because if not properly drafted, the inclusion of certain terms can result in there being a periodic tenancy in place rather than a valid tenancy at will, which of course then would have protection under the Act. So it's all a bit of a minefield.
Thank you. I'm commonly asked by clients if there are certain things that they should avoid doing on lease expiry to avoid a lease arising by implication if they have not got a clear holding arrangement in place. A key one is not to accept rent or other payments without taking advice as to how they may be able to do this, as otherwise there is a risk that a new implied tenancy giving security of tenure could be created inadvertently. Other things to think about, which are beyond the scope of today, but which we will pick up in another podcast, are looking at service of a schedule of dilapidations. Even if the tenant is to remain in occupation, you may wish to serve an interim schedule of dilapidations or one relating to the expired lease, and reinstatement of any alterations made by the tenant if the tenant is to vacate. Estate Code gives very clear guidance on this too. So that's tenancies at will. Victoria, would you be able to outline what is meant by a MOTO or a MOO, MOO or a MOO, MOU, and where these fit into what we've been discussing?
Of course, both MOTOs and MOOs tend to be commonly used for intra-NHS arrangements. And these days we tend to see MOTOs most commonly in relation to occupational arrangements of buildings owned by NHSPS. A MOTO is an acronym for Memorandum of Terms of Occupation, and a MOU, MOU, is a Memorandum of Understanding. So MOTOs will often relate to areas on a hospital site or in a healthcare building shared with others, and usually include a relocation clause for the landlord, allowing the landlord to move the occupied space around the building. The important thing to remember here is the lease license distinction that we've discussed, and to look at the reality of the terms of the arrangement to decide whether they can be seen as genuine license arrangements which don't attract security of tenure under the Act. If there's any risk that the arrangements will be construed as giving exclusive possession to the tenant for business purposes, then it should be considered whether a lease will be more appropriate. Maybe whether the arrangement should be excluded from the 1954 Act as a precaution, or another arrangement entered into, such as a tenancy at will, for instance, pending grant of a more formal lease. Estate Code does make it clear that historic intra-NHS arrangements, which were always dealt with by MOOs, should be reconsidered on a case-by-case basis, and in particular with intra-FT arrangements, which can be enforced in court, they should ideally be avoided. Estate Code does acknowledge that MOOs can be used in some cases, but advises that an intra-NHS occupation longer than 5 years should be by way of a formal lease, and all arrangements between FTs should be made by leases. MOOs should ensure that responsibility for repairing and cost arrangements, which may be linked to capital charges, are clearly outlined and have restricted user and dealings provisions. And these arrangements most definitely have their place, but it shouldn't be presumed by default that this is always the correct arrangement to use. So I think that brings us nicely on to the last part of today's podcast. Lisa, can you give us an outline of what a state code may recommend needs considering for particular types of occupier which are not NHS organisations?
Yes, a state code has a good section on this. It's in section 6 of part B. I've just picked out a few examples. So firstly, looking at leases to the third sector and other public sector organisations, a state code makes the point that these are likely to be business leases and therefore should be excluded from the 1954 Act, and concessionary rents should only be granted where there are very clear healthcare benefits. Where there is only sessional use, so for example, use on a couple of days between, you know, the hours of say 10 o'clock and midday, then licences may well be appropriate. A concessionary lease is a lease granted at less than the market value rent and may be appropriate, provided that a trust can demonstrate that the financial loss through the rent is matched by an equivalent financial or service benefit. A business case is likely to be needed to demonstrate this and the equivalent value for money being received. Generally, a state code indicates that these arrangements should not be entered into with other public sector bodies with their own separate funding streams or, indeed, purely commercial bodies. It's important to limit the length of these leases to be no more than 7 years, is what a state code recommends, to restrict the use to the very particular use of the occupier, and to provide for the reversion to the NHS when the stated purpose comes to an end. So basically for that lease to end, so that the NHS has full control of the area when the use stops. There should be no permitted underletting or assignment, and where a certain value is exceeded, it may be necessary to get additional public sector consents. It's very common to see a number of retail outlets on hospital sites, in particular in new concourse redevelopments. A state code acknowledges that leases of retail outlets can generate good returns for NHS trusts, in addition to enhancing the patient and staff experience. But it does make it clear that, as negotiation of the terms of these arrangements may be more commercial and tactical, it's really important to get professional advice. Valuation advice is important to ensure that the best return is made by the NHS Trust in these arrangements. The key areas to be held in mind, over and above exclusion from the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, of course, are ensuring that there are certain restrictions on items sold, clear mandatory opening times to align with patient and staff needs, clear reflection of the Trust's ESG policies, particularly focusing on health and well-being being reflected in the items which are being sold. Consideration of turnover rents as a top-up to a basic rent. And to think carefully about having all-inclusive rents rather than a rent with a separate service charge, which may require additional NHS resource to manage. There are more recommendations in a state code, but this list gives you a flavour. Additional commercial insurance top-ups should also be considered, with the cost ideally being passed to the tenant. In any case, lettings of this nature should be disclosed and checked with NHS resolution for the PES scheme purposes. That's the property expenses scheme. Similarly, lettings of advertising hoardings and notice boards need to be carefully monitored and align with trust policies and values. The content and objectives of the advertising and what's going to be put on the notice boards needs to be carefully monitored. There are many occupational arrangements on trust sites which are linked to service contracts, and those should definitely include a clause to allow the trust as landlord to terminate where the service contract ends, whether early or on expiry. For this clause to work, the lease must be excluded from the 1954 Act. Car parking arrangements are always a hot topic, and trusts should carefully consider whether a lease or license arrangement is the correct form of arrangement for use by a car parking operator, including issues relating to security of tenure and whether or not charges will be made for parking. Telecommunications leases fall within a particular and complex statutory regime, which is beyond the scope of this podcast. But the point to make here is that all trusts should take specialist advice before entering into any arrangement with a telecommunications provider for use of any part of their estate.
Thanks, Lisa. Estate code really is very comprehensive and there's a lot to consider here, but as you say, Section 6 of Part B highlights the key points very well. I'd like to end with a very important practical tip linked to estate housekeeping. It's really easy to forget this once a transaction is completed, and this advice is also backed up by estate code. But trusts should ensure they have an active terrier system on which to record all letting arrangements, and also to ensure they have a system in place to be reminded of key dates, such as term expiries, rent reviews, any break dates in a lease. This will ensure that those arrangements and dates are not reliant solely upon the collective knowledge and memory of the trust, and will allow the trust estates team to manage and consider any issues arising in good time. And that will also mean that appropriate timely action can be taken to protect the trust's estate and effectively manage any risks that may arise from them. This is really important for the smooth running of an NHS estate, because a failure to recognise key dates and timescales can lead to legal issues and additional costs, which may then ultimately adversely impact the trust's ability to deliver core services.
Thank you, Victoria. That's very wise advice and a key take-home point from today. So a good note and a good reminder on which to bring this second episode of our NHS Estate Code series to an end. Thank you very much to everybody for joining us, and thank you to Victoria too for taking part, and we look forward to welcoming you to the next episode in this podcast series very shortly.